Guess we can begin. Okay, so this is class three on the Burning House by Shanti Garba, a Buddhist response to the climate and ecological emergency. And just a little spiel that I give at the beginning of each of these classes. I think, obviously, this particular issue is extremely important, but I think a lot of what he talks about, a lot of what we're going to talk about, is relevant to any major issue in the world, any major issue of suffering and destruction. And just, I think everybody's, it looks like most everybody's been involved already, but in discussing something like this, I mean, people have not seemed to be inclined in the last couple of classes to go down the rabbit holes of debating particular solutions and, you know, should you drive an electric car or not? Because then the battery comes from, you know, like we're not getting into those kinds of specific debates, not that they're not important to have at some point, but more but we're not also sticking with it so generally that it's just like, well, we just want world peace, you know. So it's, we're trying to get specific, but we don't want to get too much into the details. So we're walking the middle way between everything being too general and getting bogged down in specifics. So speak from your own experience, go ahead and share decisions you have made about how to live, but just everyone be careful about getting on a soapbox, as this doesn't really convert anybody else anyway. And then the second thing, just focusing on our own practice and trusting others to do their practice. So really keeping everything focused on ourselves in terms of responsibility and practice, as opposed to kind of complaining about those people who do that. So just so that's just a little preamble. So this chapter was chapter three, called Environmental Ethics. And I realize some of you may not have not read this, but if you did, I've promised to kind of just pause at this point to see if anything came up for anyone who did the reading, any questions or comments or something that you'd like to make sure that I cover. And I don't know. So if you are in the dirt zendo, you know how to raise your hand. If you're in the cloud zendo, you know, you can do the little reactions button and your little hand will go up until I have a chance to get to you. So feel free to do that at any
Dennis.
point.
Dennis. Oh, no, that's just the mouse.
We thought somebody had their hand up. No. So yeah, feel free to raise your hand at any point too, and I can pause and we can discuss more. So there's three things that I wanted to pull out of this chapter three. Now, I realized the website said we were going to do chapter three and four, but I didn't remember that until I was done preparing for the class. And I was like, oh well, I guess we'll do chapter four next week. But there was plenty of stuff in here. So essentially, we're going to start with the idea of contrition, then move on to the idea of collective karma, and then under interdependence and empathy. That's a lot, plenty of material. So this chapter starts with a poem of apology. And I will just read it. This is by Sangharakshita, so that's the teacher of Shantigarbha. And I don't necessarily like, not everything in this poem appeals to me, but the general attitude of it. An apology. Humankind owns a profound apology to the birds for having polluted the air through which they fly, to the ape and the tiger for having destroyed the forests in which they live, to the deer and the bison for ruthlessly hunting them almost to extinction, to the rivers and streams for poisoning them with chemicals, to the earth itself for greedily pillaging its riches of silver and gold, to the ocean for slaughtering the greatest of her children, the whale, for scientific purposes. To the mountain peaks for defiling their virgin snows with our trash. To the moon for rudely invading her sacred space. To the stars for obscuring their brightness with the smoke of our cities. To the sun for not gratefully acknowledging our dependence on his bounty. To the truly great men and women of the past for not honoring their memory as we should and for not walking in their footsteps. So I'm not necessarily resonate with all of that. I don't think we really violated the moon, but in any case, the idea of contrition seems very appropriate. And it's very central to our practice. Our 16 Bodhisattva precepts begin with a statement of contrition. So our Bodhisattva precepts are moral guidelines. All harmful karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, I now atone for it all. And we atone. To atone means to make amends or reparation, or to make up as for errors or deficiencies. Or the synonyms are apologize, redress, or repair. So, you know, many folks having come from other religious traditions get a little suspicious when we start talking about contrition, you know, not wanting to go down the road of like guilt and shame and stuff like that. But in our tradition, it's more like this is a stage that we have to go through, or I mean, we have to repeatedly go through this sense of contrition, coming, acknowledging our shortcomings or what we have done or the harm we have caused, atoning in the sense of like, all right, I take responsibility for it. I think of it as the buck stops here. And we say beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance because, well, for one thing, we say there's no inherent self here who is to blame for any of this. Plus, we are the way we are for countless reasons. Genetics, culture, you know, circumstances when we're growing up, all kinds of things like that have contributed to how we are. Some of our own choices as well. What we're saying is wherever it came from, I ended up with this and I'm taking responsibility for it. So we don't dwell in guilt or shame or inferiority or carry around a sense of being insufficient. We just express regret and vow to do better. So I think there's something very valuable about this idea when it comes to thinking about our climate and ecological emergency, because I think most of us, as we are looking and trying to open our hearts to the suffering and destruction, we feel at least partly culpable. And that, for me anyway, sometimes that sense of not just sadness and horror at what is happening, but then my own culpability in it, you know, just by participating in this society or just by not, I don't know, putting my life on the line to stop it or something is makes me partly culpable. So it has not only been a source of grief, but then also, strangely, can actually cut me off from the natural world. In some ways, being close to nature then just reminds me of all the shit that we're doing to it. You know, being at the ocean and just thinking of all the plastic and how the ocean is warming up, and you know, just almost everywhere we look now, there's nowhere we can look where we have not started to ruin things. So it's difficult to face. I had a experience, so I had that experience of going to the ocean, and it's a lovely visit to the coast. It's always such a treat to be able to go, but actually it was just kind of making me sad. And then a few months later, I had the opportunity last summer to go drive up from California and stopped in the Redwood Grove, Richardson's Grove. It's just these trees are just mind-boggling. They're just, I mean, you really cannot, like, the human mind just cannot get around these trees. They are so tall and so old. They're like 3,000 years old. I mean, the trees that I was looking at had blackened bark. So a fire had come through, and they're very resistant to fire. So I asked at the interpretive center, like, when did that fire happen? They're like, we don't know. Like, that fire happened before. I mean, there's no stories the indigenous people tell about it, certainly since the white people came. It happened, huh?
Did you say 3,000 years old?
3,000 years old.
That's older than Buddhism.
I mean, yeah, good point. Those trees were growing here before Buddhism. You just can't even get your mind around it. And then just thinking about, that in California fires recently, sequoias were threatened, and if we keep going down this road, even things like that will be destroyed. So I'm just, oh. But as I reached out to touch the bark of this tree, and I wanted to, I don't know, I wanted to feel a connection, to feel that restorative quality of nature, but that, all that crap was kind of getting in the way. And I found it that if I said the karma verse to the tree, like I said, I'm sorry. I'm all our human past and harmful karma, born from our beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born through our bodies, mouths, and minds. I'm now atoned for it. I'm sorry. And it was like, I don't know, that gave a kind of authentic connection that wasn't possible unless I ex yeah, sure gets it.
That'll be quick. Speaking of the Native Americans, we are on the land of the Kayapuyas here in Oregon, and I know you visited the Old Oak a while ago. This whole valley used to be an oak savanna, and the Native Americans who lived here, the Kayapuya and others, would make fires to take care of the oaks, make fires to get rid of all the lower growth around it, little pine trees and whatever stuff was growing around it. And they did that for years. They knew that the big oaks wouldn't catch on fire and that sort of thing. And you talked about the path, following the path of our ancestors. I think of the path of the Native Americans who were always taking care of nature and loving it. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Although, as I was thinking about this process of contrition in this circumstance, it opens up the issue, though, of like, well, how do I atone for it, right? I can express the regret. Now, this is something in our personal practice. When we come to this point where we're like, I want to live differently, all my past and harmful karma, I atone for it. And then it's like, okay, now we have the practice, we have the teachings, and we have Zazen, and we have Sangha, and we have, we know what to do to start working on ourselves. But when it comes to this, essentially collective karma, what can we do? How do we atone for this? So that's the tricky thing here. So Shanti Garba said, says, writes, so Buddhist ethics is not simply a matter of good or bad. It's the state of mind or volition that counts. And the more awareness and imagination you have, the more you are able to act in a skillful way. This comes with practice and experience. It means taking responsibility for the likely consequences of our actions, bearing in mind that we don't have certain knowledge about the future. And in the present climate and ecological emergency, it means taking collective responsibility for the likely consequences of our collective actions. We could even see it as collective karma, in the sense that humans have performed certain kind of actions and they have a certain kind of result. So traditionally, Buddhism has not discussed collective karma. It's just been focused on like your individual karma. Greed, hate, and delusion lead to negative consequences. So why, but it's clear that like the same principles apply. You know, collective greed, which might take the form of overconsumption, disregard for consequences and costs, essentially stealing, you know, colonialism, hate, and fear, othering, discounting the well-being of other individuals, communities, and nations, delusion, thinking we can just extract and consume and grow with no limit whatsoever on a finite planet, thinking we're separate from nature. So all of these things that we're collectively doing are causing untold suffering and further perpetuating greed, hate, and delusion. So it's like all of it is still applies. So why doesn't Buddhism talk about it? I mean, unless it's starting to, but it's a kind of a new thing, this idea of using the same terms to talk about collective karma. And I would say Buddhism is a human creation and it's evolving. And frankly, the practices that we do as individuals, like those are things like we can do. That's within our own individual purview. It may not be easy all the time, but we have some control of our own choices, our own words, actions, behaviors. But we can't directly control other people or our society as a whole or something like that. So what does it mean to practice collectively? We have our individual practice, and yet somehow collectively we need to take responsibility for our karma. So this is a modern koan for Buddhism, as well as Buddhists. What might collective practice even mean? What might it look like? We can imagine results we'd like to see, like we would like to see, us living sustainably on the earth and, you know, respecting all people so everybody has, you know, the basic needs met. And I can think of all the things that would be great, but the practice question is how do we get there? But the fact that Buddhism doesn't have the answers at this point doesn't mean it's not useful. Because its strength lies in the process of inquiry it gives us, not in any fixed set of answers. So using our practice, we can find out. But we do need to hold this koan before us. How do we practice collectively as human beings in order to minimize our collective greed, hate, and delusion? We also need to practice all the way along as individuals. That would be complementary. How do we face what's going on without getting overwhelmed? How do we find equanimity and clarity? But something collective is also required. And whatever collective practice looks like, it can't be forced, right? Like, we may need to make changes in our world, you know, just like unilateral, like this has to happen. We got to phase out fossil fuels, bam. It's not a matter of getting everybody in on it and, you know, singing kumbaya. And yet, in the long run, living sustainably on this earth, the kind of practice we're talking about, it's not something you can force. So how would we even draw people to that? How would we connect people to it? A key, I think, is imagination. So Norman Fisher is a Zen priest and author of a book called The World Could Be Otherwise, which we studied at one point in the past. And he talks about the necessary, like, and again, Buddhism is evolving. So this kind of introduction of the word imagination as being important to this whole process is new, but I think fits fine. And Shanti Garba said, the more imagination and awareness you have, the more you will be able to act in a skillful way. Can you imagine what collective practice could look like? Maybe it's explicitly Buddhist for Buddhists, but maybe it transcends Buddhism while taking advantage of its wisdom. What Buddhist teachings, practices, and ethical guidelines could be applied collectively? How could people come together to practice in this way? Practice gathering aimed at collective liberation and transformation, not only personal. So, let's see, that was contrition and collective karma. Before I go on to interdependence and empathy, any thoughts or comments or questions? Leah, and then Denny.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, about what you said about imagining what gatherings look like that like transcend just Buddhism. I think it's the interfaith piece. I personally am very interested in that. And for some reason, not sure why, I'm trying to sort of drill down to it, but for some reason, I'm really convinced that it has to be more than just Buddhists, because I mean, just practically, Buddhism in America, we're talking about a minority, even though we may wish it were, maybe it's growing, and you know, that's wonderful, but I mean, it's just that so many more people, I think, would really benefit and be into it. And there are more people now that are not going to church at all anyway, but they have maybe spiritual thoughts or ideas. So I don't know. When you said that, I was like, oh, well, yeah, it has to transcend just Buddhism, because, you know, otherwise I'm not sure about the imagination, how that would look. When I imagine it, it always looks like a lot more people than that. So.
Denny. You're still muted, by the way.
Thank you. When we were talking about hope the other day in a Q&A, I think that was right before the Rohatsu retreat, I don't know if I express myself very well, but I remember thinking that hope could be skillful as long as there was intention and volition behind your investment in hope. Mm-hmm. And the next day I was thinking about that, and And I was surprised and so happy to see this in the chapter that we read, that in order to have intention, you kind of have to be able to imagine what you want to create. And that process of connecting with what is most important, what you think will be healing and bringing people together, it strengthens intention and it strengthens your determination. And I don't know how possible or under what circumstances you could go through that activity in a group of people, but it seems to me that that would be, might be a good way to just get people connected and sharing inspiration. And then I was listening just today to your fourth podcast on your podcast about the environment. And you talked about three or four kinds of hope, I think. And the second one, you may not remember that, but just coincidentally, the second one also was the most, the one to really strive for, because it was connected to intention. And so all of this, I just love it when things come together like that. And but real quickly, I also think that if you feel stuck, there are so many things that you can do just by yourself. If you have a little piece of ground, which I have, I've been working for the last 20 years on planting and composting and building up the health of the soil and planting everything that I could to support the insects and the birds and the possums and everything that's back there. And it's sustaining, and people come over there and they see that, and they're, and this surprised me, but they're inspired by it and they go home and try to do it. So those are just two thoughts that just sort of came to me as you were talking.
The second part there is something that's going to get tied in to what I'm going to talk about next. And what you're saying, though, about the, I think I see over the last 5 to 10 years, I see more of a collective vision taking shape. You know, when groups like Green Faith that I've gotten involved in and stuff like, and the Pope and whatever, I mean, there's kind of, it's starting to become clear, like a shared vision of what needs to happen. So let's see, Tyler and Brian. Tyler first.
Sure. Yeah. Just I really appreciated your point about the need for imagination. And I'm gonna have to go back and read that Norman Fisher, because Norman, the World Could Be Otherwise chapter, because I remember us reading that book and enjoying it, but I don't remember the imagination part. But I mean, there's, Buddhism was created so long ago and it has been evolving, but like, none, you know, it wasn't set out to give us a set of tools because we were going to need to save the planet from something, or, you know, to like end these like this. So, but like, it gives us such a, it didn't really like lay out how, there's ways you can practice, but like how you can use, take your Buddhist philosophies and put them into practice, your Buddhist spirituality, put it to practice, allows for so much imagination. And what a beautiful way to engage with our faith, our spirituality, and our practice. We call it a practice, but taking that and taking it, you know, an off the cushion practice, or however you might see it. Anyways, I just, the idea of imagining, the using, like, it needs imagination. It sparked a lot of excitement, because I'm lucky enough to, you know, in my school, it focuses on imaginative play, and I see kids' imaginations explode daily in directions I would never have, you know, would never coach, I'd never coach them, or they just figured it out. But it's inspiring to think about that we can start doing that with our yeah, practice here. So thank you.
Brian.
I hope this isn't a rabbit hole, but I've lived, worked most of my life overseas and lived in undeveloped countries, third world nations. And I live on an island now. I'm a tree hugger because when you live on an island, you don't really start to worry about where your garbage is going. And so we're quite conscious about that, and we recycle everything. And even in the last couple of years, my recycling has come down by, 50%. But I still, this came up when you, even from the first session you had about this, I thought about going back 20, 30 years ago, driving in Jakarta, coming home from work. So, at that point, it was like 16 million people then in that city, all jammed together. And the rainy season comes, and you're trying to get home, and you can't because the roads are flooded, because the open sewers have overflowed because of the of all the garbage and all the pollution and everything. And I say to my driver, Hassan, Hassan, why doesn't you guys do something about this? The government's in places. And he told me this has always stuck with me, and I guess it's that's why I'm saying I want to be an outlier. But he says, environmental concerns and stuff like that, Mr. Little, are a luxury of the have countries. He says, not the have-not countries. We are more concerned about, just what's the cheapest way and what's, how we can do, how we can live and make a living. We don't have the luxury. We don't have the taxes. We don't have any of those things to help the environment. And then you just look at the statistics. The number one polluter in the world, and again, this was not outlier, is China. Not per capita, but the largest. They're double the United States. And then after them comes India. And I've lived in these countries. And I lived in a resort and there was stuff which, we tried to do a lot of stuff that was green. But they just, it's cultural. They just take the garbage and they just throw it in the ditch. They just throw it in the bushes. And while it's nice and green, you don't see it. And then when the dry season comes and leaves fall, all you see is plastic bottles and little tiny things. Even their ceremonies where they have little cups that, because they always give you free cups. That's it. So they're drinking the water. And but the adults aren't changing. So we used to pay the school to let the kids come out and clean up the streets or the areas. So it was almost like the older people, it's a lost cause. So we were trying for the newer, younger kids. But when you see it around the world in all these different places, it doesn't matter where you go. I mean, it's a luxury, coming here. Yes, we could afford it because we got recycled plants and all that type of stuff there. They don't.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm gonna have to move on to the next one.
Move on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why at the COP28 right now, the one of the main discussions is that like one of the main things that needs to happen is the have countries have to like and at this point they're even just talking about kind of like repair and whatever, but like it's got to be much more than that. It's got to be much more than that.
Well,
So
I was going to talk about that, and they just ended yesterday, COP28, and they couldn't come to agreement on it. Like the U.S. wanted to do a lot of green things, like Biden's offer, and
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
and we're
Well, I mean, we could talk about COP28 quite a lot,
yeah.
but let's move on to this one other piece. So the interdependence and empathy. Shantigarbha mentions the Buddhist teaching of Indra's net. Well, it's actually a pre-Buddhist teaching. It came from Hinduism or Vedic tradition, but it was adopted by Mahayana Buddhism, the image of Indra's net. So Indra is one of the Vedic gods, and he has a net, an infinitely big net. You kind of think of it as two dimensions, but might as well be like three dimensions too, right? And at every interstice or whatever this is called, the spots where the rope pieces come together, there's a jewel. And every jewel reflects all the other jewels. So we're like, you might be a jewel in Indra's net, but at the same time, we reflect all the other jewels. So this is kind of classic Buddhist metaphor for interdependence. And we know, I think all of us here have a basic understanding of ecology and the way that things work, and we recognize like we're actually very like the level of interdependence we have with other people and other countries and with nature is just we're much more dependent than independent. But that connection, that sense of connection, needs to not just be theoretical or abstract. And so Shanti Garba, a couple times in the chapter, was talking about the need to, that like our ethics are ultimately based in like this volition and this sense of connection. Let me see, quoted something from the Buddha. Said, when the Buddha invited his followers in a classic teaching to reflect that all beings are terrified of death. To all, life is dear. When we see this, killing becomes unthinkable. Ethics is really to do with feeling solidarity with all life. It's a direct recognition of the life in us, in others. This is clearly a kind of imaginative act, a kind of imaginative empathy. It is direct and immediate, and may be completely intuitive, without thought, instinctive. We simply resonate with the life in another person or animal. This is the ethics of empathy, the natural resonance of life for life. In its highest expression, it can lead to a spontaneous outpouring of compassion, acting for the greatest benefit of all. So let's see, we have 15 minutes. Let's see if we can do this exercise. So I wanted to get into small groups. We'll come back together at the end, but probably not have much of a chance to do much or debrief. So then Tyler will be 10 minutes. probably don't have time. But the thing is, I wanted everybody to have a natural object in their hand while we contemplated this question. So in the Zendo, I brought in a bunch of stuff from my backyard, which people can pass around and take something. And if you are at home, you want to like run outside and grab something, or maybe you have something inside. Rock or a leaf or something natural, something not human made.
Banana.
Yeah.
Is the banana?
So those in the dirt Zendo, you could start moving into small groups, and then I'll let you know what the question is. So get in groups of three-ish. So this is a question from, I never even turned on my amplifier. This is a question from Shanti Garba. He said, a quote from his teacher, I guess. His teacher said, "A universe conceived of as dead cannot be a universe in which one stands any chance of attaining enlightenment." And I think of rephrasing that as, it is impossible to spiritually awaken as an individual when one sees everything beyond the sphere of human concern as lifeless or irrelevant. So I can broadcast that question to the Zoom folks. I can repeat it for you guys in the Zendo if you want. But yeah, so the question is, what does this mean? How is this so? And why is it so? Why is this so? Like, our individual awakening is not possible as long as we view all of life as being, you know, unimportant or irrelevant or lifeless. All right.
Can we keep our little pieces of your backyard?
And the old, there was an acorn in there too, which wasn't from my backyard. Yeah. So I just wanted to leave with a reading from the Avatamsaka Sutra, which Shanti Garba mentioned in the chapter as being one of the places that Indra's net image, it actually doesn't, as far as I can tell, doesn't actually appear. But this sutra, if you're not familiar with it, is to my mind, it's all about imagination. It's all about kind of stretching the mind. And I like to think that actually I'd be willing to bet a lot that in 10 years, things will have happened that we cannot even imagine, and not just terrible things, right? Like, I think the way out of this crisis may change our societies and our nations and the whole way that we live on this planet in ways that, frankly, that's why I've been reading science fiction lately, because it's so great at just being like, yeah, why don't we do that? I mean, so this is a little bit of like Buddhist science fiction for you to just, it's actually meant, as I understand it, it's really meant to be read out loud. It's meant to be heard. If you read it, you're kind of like, what? So this is from a chapter. Now the Avatamsaka, the Flower Ornament Sutra, is this. And this is like, I don't know, this is easily got more pages than the Bible. And this is from a chapter called The Incalculable, which spends the first part of it, the Buddha said, is trying to explain how incalculable, measureless the Buddha's virtues are. And he said, 10 to the 10th power times 10 to the 10th power equals 10 to the 20th power. 10 to the 20th power times 10 to the 20th power equals 10 to the 40th power. And it goes on. It goes on. And goes on. And like, I mean, there's like really long numbers. It's like it just keeps on doing this multiplication to a very like impossibly incomprehensible large number. So then he speaks in some verses. On the body of each Buddha appear unspeakably many pores. In each of these pores, they manifest unspeakably many forms. The unspeakably many pores each radiate unspeakably many beams of light. And in each of those beams of light, appear unspeakably many lotuses. And in each of these lotuses are unspeakably many petals. In each of those petals appear unspeakably many forms. In those untold forms also appear untold petals. In the petals are untold light rays. In the light rays, untold forms. In each of those untold forms appear untold lights. In the lights appear untold moons. And the moons also manifest untold moons. In each of those untold moons appear untold beams of light. And in each of those light beams also appear untold suns. In each of those untold suns are manifest untold forms. And in each of those forms again are manifest untold rays of light. In each of those rays of light appear untold lion thrones, each with untold ornaments, each with untold lights, with untold beautiful forms in the lights, with untold pure lights in the forms. In each of those pure lights also appear various subtle lights. These lights also radiate various lights. Untold, unspeakably many. In each of these various lights appear wondrous jewels like mountains. The jewels appearing in each light are unspeakably many, untold. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.